НАТО усиливает свою агрессивную риторику.
Россия испытывает НАТО на прочность. Об этом
Кремль начал в открытую говорить о возможности.
НАТО отвергает российские предложения создать внеблоковую систему.
В центре внимания Альянса будет политика в Восточной Европе.
2 years ago, NATO was in emergency mode. Today, the Atlantic Alliance is planning for a long, intense conflict. When NATO heads of state gathered for the alliance's summit in Wales in September 2014, the conflict in Ukraine was just months old, and Russia's aggressive stance towards the West was just taking shape. Hybrid war was still a fresh term. But if Wales 2014 was about an immediate response to a crisis, next week's NATO summit in Warsaw will be about building the stable architecture for what appears to be a long-term standoff with Moscow. It's also taking place in the emotionally charged environment following Great Britain's vote to leave the European Union. So what can we expect in Warsaw? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And also joining us via Skype from Kyiv is Andreas Umland of the Institute of Euro-Atlantic Cooperation. Welcome back, Andreas.
Hello.
So NATO has a lot on its plate next week and will be making some decisions that should probably resonate for decades. Top items on the agenda include beefing up troop presence in the Baltics, Poland, and Romania, intensified cooperation with non-NATO members Sweden and Finland, cyber warfare, and the migrant crisis. And then there's the perennial question of what to do about NATO aspirants Georgia and Ukraine, which obviously will not be getting any invitations to join the alliance at this summit. Mark, what will you be watching for at this summit?
To be honest, I mean, all the points you've raised are obviously sort of important ones. I mean, I think there are four, and they all come down to effectively questions of calibration and balance. The first one is, of course, the impact of Brexit, which, although everyone is giving assurances won't have a security impact, clearly will. But I know we're coming to that in the second part of the podcast. The second one, I think, is the calibration of rhetoric and reality. Historically, one of the problems with NATO has been, shall we say, that it has been prone to talk loudly and carry a teeny tiny stick. And I think what we could do with seeing is, and this is something that Jens Stoltenberg has actually been doing, is dialing back some of the more extreme rhetoric and claims, but at the same time seeking to actually build up serious and meaningful responses. Because I think the problem is at the moment is that there is a risk of NATO acquiring a credibility gap. The third point is the balance between the immediate and the long term. I mean, you're absolutely right that the Wales summit was very much about immediate crisis mode. Well, I think although it's not that I'd say the immediate crisis is gone, I think that I would like to see a lot more emphasis being put on long term, on accepting precisely that this is, shall we say, a long war, admittedly a cultural, unfortunately, sort of deterrent war, shall we say, rather than a shooting. So it's issues like that whole issue point of getting more members to actually put 2% of their GDP into defence, as has been promised, and generally building up the kind of forces that will mean that we won't be constantly looking for the need for instant scrambles to deal with issues. And this doesn't necessarily mean huge expenditure necessarily, but the right expenditure. For example, I mean, obviously at the moment we're particularly worried about Russia, and there are those, particularly sort of fueled by the recent RAND war games, that sort of suggested that Russia could rush in and seize the Baltic states without NATO doing anything. Well, okay, there already are moves being done to that. But more generally, if Russia is adopting a more aggressive and tank-heavy strategy, which it does seem to be, then we need to be thinking about response to that. And as I said, that can actually be cost-effective, because you don't need to match Russia in tanks. What you need to do is to match Russia in advanced tank-killing weapons. And a T-14 Armata tank costs $3.7 million, but an advanced Javelin missile costs something like $80,000. So there is economies to be made. So, and the very final balance is precisely between, shall I say, military and, although I hate the expression hybrid, but hybrid defences. Although there's a sharp limit as to what NATO can do about these sort of other more subtle threats, such as intelligence and financial penetration and information operations and so forth. But nonetheless, I would like to see NATO you know, addressing as more than just a bolt-on notion, how it actually addresses these non-kinetic, non-military issues, or how far it needs to push other bodies, such as the European Union, to be doing that more seriously.
And there's been talk that there's going to be increased cooperation and coordination between NATO and the European Union, although all that talk was happening pre-Brexit. I'm hoping it continues. Andreas, what are you looking for?
Well, I find that all a little bit surrealistic in a certain way, because one can certainly understand the fears that the Balts have and the Polish and other NATO member countries that are now in some sort of conflict with Russia. But I think many people simply forget that we are not in the Cold War now, and that Russia is not the USSR. And therefore, this entire setting that I see now is actually, I think, not appropriate to the real situation. And the real situation is that the Russian Federation is not the USSR. There's no Soviet bloc. And what is even more important, the Russian Federation is actually part of the Western world. In spite of the sanctions, there's still a lot of trade going on, a lot of investment going on, a lot of bank accounts, a lot of tourism going on. You just have to go on the streets of the major cities in Europe, and you will see Russians, you will see Russian companies. And there's a lot of interdependence between Russia and the West. And still there is this sort of Cold War confrontation again. And what I see here is... in a way that we are taking upon us risks that we shouldn't be taking upon us, because we have other means that are non-military that would be much more effective and that could have an easy effect on Russia, which we are not using. Instead, we are getting into this confrontation. And I think actually partly this entire mood that I see now in NATO emerging is something that Russia wants to create. It wants to have counter-reactions from NATO. It needs to feed its narrative of a basic confrontation between Russia and the West. And so I think this whole confrontation is a little bit surrealistic.
Well, let's pick up on that. I mean, let's look at the things that we expect NATO to approve at this summit, because they've all been telegraphed, but a lot of them have been telegraphed. We're talking about four battalions of approximately 1,000 troops each, placed in the three Baltic states and Poland. One will be commanded by the United States, one by Germany, one by the UK, and one to be determined. The likely candidate is Canada right now, although that has not been decided. Romania has also asked to host and command an additional battalion located in Romania. That is still to be decided. This doesn't really look like a huge overreaction, given what's going on NATO's Eastern Front. How do we assess this piece of what to expect in Warsaw? Andreas,
Well, I think the reaction as such is probably appropriate, because obviously the countries that are requesting that help, they have very serious concerns, and I wouldn't want to question the legitimacy of their interests. But on the other hand, I mean, there is this strange situation. We are getting into this escalating situation with Russia, although Russia is our trade partner, and we have lots of Russian tourists and the bank accounts and the real estate and the kids at the universities and all these things going on, which are obviously in contradiction to this military confrontation. We have other leverages that we can use, and we do not need to be on the verge of a sort of World War III with this country, which is partly part of our system.
So you're saying, let me push back against that slightly, if I may, though. I mean, I think I absolutely agree that the last thing we want is some kind of new Cold War confrontation. Not that I think that we're actually anywhere near getting there. But the Cold War was the aberration. Actually, it's quite normal for countries to have high levels of political, economic, and social interpenetration and yet still be on a war footing. That is the history of Europe. for almost its entire period. I mean, for heaven's sake, most of the crowned heads were part of one large extended inbred family, even while their particular countries were at war. So, I mean, I think that's quite normal. What we really have to appreciate is, I mean, I have limited enthusiasm for the idea of putting out of security on solely or even primarily military means. I mean, I agree there are all kind of other instruments that can be used much more effectively. But nonetheless, first of all, look, Moscow can create the narrative of war footing and so forth, regardless of what NATO did. If NATO actually disbanded half its forces and sent the rest of them out to go flower picking, that would still, that would not have any impact on the narrative if Moscow wanted to create one. But secondly, look, you build up military forces in part as deterrent. And I think there's no harm in having deterrent against a country that has demonstrated a will to use military force when it feels it can do so safely and easily. It's simply to sort of almost in some ways to help the saner heads in Moscow prevail. Secondly, it is, as you've mentioned, reassurance. To not make countries feel that they've been stuck out there in a vulnerable no man's land, and therefore have to cut deals with Russia that they might not want to make. But thirdly, look, this is not just simply about NATO Russia. Just because at the moment we're focusing on Russia, we've got to bear in mind that there's a whole variety of other potential security issues, and part of this, what I meant about this issue of balance, is not just thinking about what's going to happen tomorrow and the evil Russian hordes pouring into the Baltic states, which is not going to happen, but also actually thinking about long-term sensible strategic planning. And that's what you need that 2% for, because you need to have a variety of different instruments. So, I mean, I think when we come back to these battalions...
Yeah, I'd be interested in your take on that.
These are not... In some ways, these are not really war-fighting formations. You know, 1,000 troops here and 1,000 troops there, however good they may well be, however well equipped, you know, are not the sort of not going to actually sort of turn the tide in case there was an actual apocalyptic war with Russia. They are political markers. They're political markers that say, first of all, look, if you want to go into these countries, you're going to be in a position where you're not just necessarily going to be killing Estonians or Latvians, but Americans or Germans, which is, I think, very significant. But secondly, it's a political marker that says, You basically tried to lean on us not to do this, and we're doing it anyway. I mean, as much as anything else, it's actually a political expression that says certain political tactics that you have tried, and certainly the heavy metal diplomacy, the militarized diplomacy that Russia sort of very much tries to use, it has not worked, and therefore please stop doing it in the future.
Andreas, what about that?
Yes, I agree. I mean, as I said, there has to be some reaction to that. But I'm not saying that I have a solution for this. But we are in a very contradictory situation, that we are feeding with the reaction that we with the rhetorical reactions from NATO. We are feeding this sort of narrative in Russia. And we are feeding this narrative with military reactions, although we have other instruments. What I see here in a way is that we have, for instance, the private interests of the companies in the West that are engaged in the oil import from Russia. And oil, as you probably know, I mean, is a large part of the Russian budget. Most of the oil export goes to the EU. Most of that export goes through the pipelines. So we would have this leverage to actually we could have some sort of regime where we sanction Russia to the degree that Russia escalates militarily. But we don't do that, not because we need this Russian oil so desperately, but because there are private interests that are preventing us from using our economic leverage that we have. The same goes for bank accounts, for real estates, and so on. We have other instruments, but instead of that, we're getting into this military confrontation. And the worst thing about it is that the bill, I think, will not be paid for that by the Baltic states or any NATO member countries, but probably by countries like Georgia and Ukraine that have not the protection of NATO and that can also not count on the on the economic support from the EU. I think the EU is actually here the more important instrument, because the EU can could increase sanctions, for instance, to protect Estonia, let's say, but it cannot, or it will not do it. It should, I think, but it will probably not do so in the interests of Georgia and Ukraine, or at least not to the same degree as for a EU member country. So I think it's just, for me, it's a bizarre situation. It's if Russia was an autarkic country, if Russia would have other trade options, if the Russian elite would not be as heavily involved in sort of Western cultural and other life, then this whole confrontation would make sense in a way. But because Russia is still so much interconnected, especially its elite is so much interconnected with the West, I think there's a contradiction here. I'm not sure how much that compares to historic analogies, but I think what remains is that we would have other instruments to respond, and we're getting dragged into this military field where indeed Russia has something to present. I mean, in military terms, certainly Russia is up to a confrontation, but not in economic and financial terms.
But sanctions can't actually deter. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that there are a whole variety of other instruments. But apart from the fact that obviously NATO can't be talking about economic sanctions, let alone confiscating bank accounts or similar. I mean, NATO is a military alliance, and either NATO just sits there twiddling its thumbs, or at least it looks at the issues that it can address. But the trouble is, sanctions is something you can only do after the event. I mean, you can say we would do all kinds of terrible things to you if you even tried to, I don't know, take Estonia. And you know, my apologies to the Estonians for using them as example; they're the obvious ones. But then it wholly rests on credibility, and we have to be honest that Europe and the European Union does have a particular credibility gap as far as Moscow is concerned. The point is, though, that actually having a battalion of troops there, it is a battalion of troops there. It is a bunch of people whom you know are going to fight, and you're going to have to kill them or drive them off if you want to get beyond that. Sanctions would only apply after the event, so it would essentially be a massive potential bluff. Whereas this is real, this is actual, this is definite. You know, Moscow cannot just assume that the soldiers are not going to fight because it knows that they will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially if they're American, British, and German soldiers. Yes, they can certainly count on that. Yeah, no, I would agree with Mark. These things aren't mutually exclusive. I mean, there's nothing stopping us from doing both. NATO is a military organization, and it has to focus on the kinetic aspects of the conflict.
I would also agree with that, of course. I mean, I think the military means are necessary, but I think we shouldn't be dragged into this game, because that's Russia's game, this military game. That's the sort of escalating, that's where they want to go, and what is feeding the narrative, and which is stabilizing Putin's regime. I think that's the final aim of it. But of course, NATO consists of exactly the countries where the bank accounts are, where the oil goes, where the people go for tourism, where the children of the elite study. I mean, that's the contradiction we have here, and that's very different from the Cold War period, where there was not such a kind of interdependence.
No, but as Mark pointed out, that's the history of Europe, and the Cold War was the aberration. Mark, what about that, though? Are we giving Putin what he wants here in terms of, I mean, you said that he'll spin the narrative how he wants, regardless of what we do. But is NATO giving Putin exactly what he wants, or is Putin getting a little more than he bargained for here?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
That's why
I can't help feeling, as I said, that when it comes down to it, it doesn't matter what the West did. Putin has the capacity to craft the narrative, or Putin's people have the capacity to craft the narrative however they want. And therefore, the notion that this is somehow playing into Putin's hands, I don't buy, because the point is that you might say, not only can he talk about the West in whatever frames he wants, if the West does not put up a tough, spirited, and credible deterrent, then he actually gets the ability to do what he wants to do on the cheap. I mean, in this respect, we are back into Cold War days, in the sense that this is actually not so much truly a military competition as an economic one. And just as in the Cold War, ultimately the West was able to spend Russia, or Soviet Union, into collapse. so too actually, I mean, and we're not talking about collapse, but so too actually the more that sort of there is an arms race put in these terms, then actually the more pressure it puts on a Russian economy, which is already in trouble. So, I mean, from my point of view, I see no real downsides here, as long as we do two things. One is actually be sensible about emphasizing the defensive element of this. I mean, we really do need to understand that in Moscow, it's not just rhetoric. There are people who genuinely believe that NATO is an aggressive organization and the West wants to see the current regime destroyed. And therefore, I mean, and so this is why I think that actually strong acts but quieter words are much more effective. One of the dangerous things is if, for example, we start putting the kind of forces on the front line which look like they are potentially offensive forces. This is why I think it's important to configure these things sensibly so that they're good, credible defensive elements, but not the sort of troops that you could imagine spearing their way to St. Petersburg. So that's the first issue. The second point is that we need unity in the West. That's absolutely crucial. And if we do start making it look as if we're over-militarizing the process, then the danger is we begin to actually lose political support. And in this respect, I mean, I think in a way we can give Putin what he wants if we start looking as if it's all being driven by a handful of hawks in D.C. and maybe in a few other places, or indeed in the Baltic states or Poland. You know, there is this narrative that it's kind of hawks on the front line who are dragging the rest of Europe. I don't buy it, but nonetheless, it is there. We can give Putin ammunition for his propaganda campaigns within Europe.
Mm-hmm. No, and along the lines of the costs of this, I mean, Maxim Chertilyov, who was a guest on the podcast last week, had a really interesting piece for the Kennan Institute a couple of weeks back, where he basically said the irony of this is that Russia's arms buildup was in response to a phantom threat where the West really wasn't doing what Russia thought it was doing, right? But now the Western buildup is happening at a time when Russia really can't afford to continue the buildup that it had to this point, that where their buildup has reached the point of diminishing returns. Mark, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I've long felt that there's a danger in overstating Russia's military capabilities. Military reform has been taking place. There has been movement, but really, you've got a situation in which, frankly, maybe a third of the Russian military has been brought up to fairly good standards, and two-thirds is still in pretty poor shape, and that's not going to change any time soon. So, yeah, there are distinct limits. But, you know, we should not forget the fact that relatively small forces can actually have an impact when they are used in the right kind of context, and most importantly of all, when they're in the disposal of a regime that doesn't have to worry too much about domestic public opinion. Of course, there are constraints. This is not North Korea. But nonetheless, clearly the Kremlin has far, far more freedom of maneuver with what it does with its forces than any Western country.
And I also, and Andreas, your comments about the non-kinetic deterrence, I mean, it reminded me of something Edward Lucas said at GlobeSec, which was pretty interesting and really caught my attention, was the notion that if the West were to conduct financial snap exercises, I don't know if any of you saw this, this was written up widely. It's a very, very, very intriguing theme, but basically you basically run a financial snap exercise of what we could do to the Russian economy.
Yes, exactly. I mean,
and leak it to the press and say, you know, in the event of, you know, this is a financial snap exercise in the theoretical situation where Russia attacks the Baltics, for example.
Yes, and, or with, I don't know, I mean, you could imagine other sort of economic short-term measures that would be just a demonstration of all the things that could be applied. And they would also be a response. And I think they would actually be more effective. I mean, I don't have a solution to the problem, but the problem is that currently the NATO's reaction, they are a good precautionary measure, but they are not solving the problem. Instead, they are stabilizing the regime. They're feeding the narrative. They're making this conspirological narrative more plausible. That is a problem that for which I do not have a solution. But I think it should be acknowledged that it's problematic, and that we have other instruments. And as I mentioned already, I would be much less worried about that if there were not countries that that do not have the protection of NATO and that may at the end pay the bill for this sort of fight between Russia and NATO, because they will be the beating boys, or they will be the ones who will get then a more Russian aggressiveness, because Russia does not expect any reaction or any military reaction, at least.
But these non-kinetic measures cannot. This is not NATO's brief to do things like this. NATO, again, it's a military organization whose mission is to defend its 28 members. And that's it. That's what its mission is, and it's something NATO's gotten back to. They another thing they did.
But it's also not a supranational organization. Its ruling body is the North Atlantic Council, which consists of the members, and the member countries. They would have these instruments, and they choose to speak about military issues instead of
That's an interesting. Mark, you're the military expert here. Something NATO is contemplating. I know it's not something that's being discussed. But what about that? Can NATO get involved in non-kinetic things the SNAP financial exercises that Edward Lucas talked about?
If the SNAP financial exercise is purely a thought exercise, in theory, we could do. You know, NATO member countries could do X or Y. Yeah, theoretically, though. Frankly, it's. To do properly, it involves a considerable amount of expertise and so forth.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to it, there is no way that, for example, NATO can or would have the power to, for example, place economic sanctions, to prevent banks from moving money, from closing bank accounts, from saying we will no longer buy your oil and that kind of thing, unless the countries were willing to grant NATO extraordinary powers, at which case we have some kind of Western government structure in the form of NATO. No, I mean, I think that this is it. There are sharp limits. And the trouble is, the more you diffuse what NATO could do, then frankly, the harder and harder it gets for NATO to be a meaningful organization.
In a military
One
sense.
Of the reasons why it works at the moment is because precisely it is focused. And it's not just even on military means, but it is focused on defensive roles. It has a pretty sharp set of responsibilities. And it's interesting that when we have seen it then move into other sort of out-of-area deployments, actually, it's got to be honest, it's been much more ad hoc and ramshackle.
And less effective, yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's this question. You could theoretically do so, but you trade off a lot of unity and cohesion. Because at the moment, you know, for example, there are already tensions between northern and eastern countries and southern ones about, you know, sort of the priorities. You know, what is the biggest concern for European security? If you're in Italy, you might well think it's coming from the Middle East or from North Africa rather than actually coming from, you know, Russia. If we also then have to start into these whole issues of, you know, all these other means, it becomes incredibly complex and difficult to get any kind of sort of coherent strategy. So, I mean, I think it's more, and this is exactly what, you know, Federica Mogherini, with her new sort of global strategy for the European Union, has been trying to sort of identify, is I think we should actually think in terms of multiple complementary but different structures. I mean, we come back to this point that there are all kinds of things that the European Union is best placed for. The European Union, after all, accounts for roughly 50% of Russia's imports and exports. It also is exactly the place where Russians buy property and put their money and send their kids to and want to go, you know, traveling in and everything else. The European Union does have, as Andres has wholly correctly identified, a wealth of ways of influencing /punishing Russia if it chooses to, and if it can actually credibly muster the will to do so. But that is definitely, it's the European Union's job rather than NATO's job. NATO is in some ways, NATO is the cop, and NATO is a good cop so long as it remains that job. If NATO is also meant to be the media regulator and the financial ombudsman and everything else, then it becomes ridiculously overburdened.
Right, and this, and again, this also accentuates why the cooperation and coordination between the EU and NATO is becoming increasingly important. This was discussed at the NATO at the EU summit in Brussels. It's, I believe, going to be discussed in Warsaw at the NATO summit. So I think this discussion is something we're going to see a little bit more of going forward.
Just in addition to that, I've been to both organizations in Brussels, and I was a bit surprised how seemingly separate they function. At least the few times I've been there, I haven't seen much interaction between them. They seem to live almost separate lives. And considering that there are so many similar members, and also that the EU, for instance, has a sanctions regime that is coordinated with the sanction regimes of the US and Canada, one wonders why this is the case. I fully understand that NATO is a military organization, but the countries that are going to assemble in Warsaw are actually also largely EU member countries, and they are conducting, they having sanctions anyway. So that's what I understand, that NATO is not going to, I mean, the shape in Mons is not going to make sanctions or financial exercises. That's clear. The shape headquarter in Belgium, that's not their job. But still, the countries are the same. And as I said, it's not a supranational organization where the general secretary can say which way to go. But it's an intergovernmental organization, and all of the countries are actually what is NATO about.
Well, let's talk about a couple of the countries that are EU members but not NATO members, but that are moving a lot closer to NATO. Obviously, I'm talking about Finland and Sweden. This is going to be something that is definitely going to be on the agenda in Warsaw, is closer coordination with Finland and Sweden. Neither are going to become members right now, although support for membership is growing in both countries, more so in Sweden than in Finland, but it's growing in both countries. The foreign ministers were the most recent NATO foreign ministers meeting for the first time. You had a 28+2 formula. The foreign ministers of Finland and Sweden sat down with the NATO foreign ministers. And Sweden has just the Swedish parliament has just ratified a host nation agreement that allows NATO to conduct exercises in Swedish territory. And in the event of conflict, if Sweden agrees to this, come to Sweden's defense. I'm not going to say they're becoming members in all but name, because that's not that would be a bit of hyperbole. But they are drawing closer. And many military analysts have made the point that the defense of the true defense of the Baltic states is impossible without the cooperation of Finland and Sweden. Mark, what do you see here?
Obviously I can't make any claims to being a Scandinavianologist. but I think it's clear that we have several processes at work here. On the one hand, both Sweden and Finland clearly realize that their friends are essentially to be found in Europe and not in Moscow. And it's not just that the defense of the Baltics is impossible without the cooperation of Sweden and Finland. It's actually also that the defense of Sweden and Finland is essential for NATO. I mean, these are countries which in some ways don't need an Article 5 guarantee. Because if Russia, I cannot imagine it happening. But if Russia, for example, did decide to go into Finland, there's no way that NATO could sit back and say, well, it's out of area for us. I mean, one way or the other, whether under the aegis of NATO or just simply as a variety of other countries, they would actually have to act, because otherwise there are key strategic interests at stake. And the Swedes and the Finns know that. The Swedes have just agreed this new sort of cooperation regime with NATO. I mean, it's clear that these are precisely countries that are looking to cooperate increasingly. And I think we're also going to see more issues about things like interoperability. That's exactly the kind of preparation that you need to do if you want to join NATO, but also the preparations that you need to do if you just might well find yourself fighting alongside NATO. Mm. So, I think although there's less of a need for either country to actually make some visible, flashy declaration, which, after all, would deeply, deeply worry and annoy Moscow, the natural kind of the gradient that they're sliding down is towards closer and closer cooperation.
Any thoughts on this, Andreas?
Well, one could make the argument if we are now increasing expenditures and moving troops within NATO, shouldn't we be more worried about the countries that are not members of NATO and like Finland and Sweden? But I think this whole logic, I mean, I don't see it really working here because, I mean, countries like Finland and Sweden, they are protected in a way, I would say, by being members of the European Union, because the moment that Russia would become aggressive, let's say, towards Finland, and there's a long border, obviously Finland would ask the EU for help, and the EU would then, I think, be pressed very much to actually use its economic instruments against Russia, which it has. I think it would be very difficult for countries that are maybe not too much interested in Scandinavian affairs, like I don't know, Italy or Greece. I mean, if there is a serious conflict on the Russian-Finnish border, I think the EU would be pressed a lot to use its economic instruments. And I think the Kremlin knows that. And that's why Finland is not in trouble, I think. And I think also in Finland, people understand that they are a part of the European Union. And that is what protects them in a way. I think that is actually the main game here. And this phenomenon that the that Russia is trying to provoke NATO member countries, Sweden as well, but NATO member countries is the motivation behind is to trigger some counter reaction from NATO, so that the regime could then report to its population. You see, NATO is building up its troops, so we have to increase spending. We have to make our fortress stronger. We have to strengthen the authoritarian regime. So this is the basic dilemma we are in here, and not even speaking about, as I mentioned already, the countries in between.
Well, the countries in between is someplace I did want to go before we moved on to talking about Brexit and its impact on NATO. I mean, Georgia and Ukraine are not going to be getting anything much at this moment. NATO just approved an assistance package for Ukraine. My understanding is there's not a lot new in it. It's essentially a lot of the things that Ukraine already had put in together into one package. The question of what to do about Georgia is even thornier because Georgia is essentially they've jumped through every hoop NATO has asked them to jump through. They're basically as prepared to join the alliance as any country has been of the new members that have joined, but yet they're not going to get in for political reasons. How does NATO square this circle, Mark? I mean, is there any way to create some kind of, and Andreas, I know you have some thoughts on this as well. Is there any way to square this circle? Because these countries aren't getting in anytime soon, but NATO will not say that. Although everybody knows that's the case. How do you square this?
Yes, well, obviously when it comes down to it, after all, you know, when it comes to Georgia, it's also a question of whether or not, you know, the other NATO countries would be willing or able to fight in defense of it. Because if you have a NATO member that could be picked off, then in a way you immediately undermine the whole basis of NATO, which is an attack on one is an attack on all. I'll be honest, NATO can't really square this circle, in my opinion. It can do things to help. But in some ways, it's not NATO's job. Again, we come back to this point, which we were also talking about with the European Union, that not everything is NATO's job. NATO's job is actually really quite straightforward and quite limited. It is in defense of its member states, and its member states are largely defined in certain sort of relatively constrained geographic terms. It's not all kinds of, you know, any of our friends. I mean, there's a reason why it also doesn't extend into the Pacific and such like. So it's, in some ways, I think it's more a question of what can the states that make up NATO do to help Ukraine and to help Georgia and to help secure
Moldova.
And indeed Moldova. Oh, and frankly, I mean, you know, any of the countries that come under pressure from Moscow. And this is the point. It's come under pressure from Moscow. It's actually very hard to secure these countries. The question is actually really the big macro issue, which is, well, what can you do about Moscow? By which I'm not talking regime change or whatever, or another way, not necessarily talking about regime change, but it's about policy change in Moscow. The best way of securing Georgia, has nothing to do with providing them with political guarantees or anti-tank missiles or anything else. It's actually creating a different Muscovite atmosphere, mood. Yeah.
But yet in Bucharest, a promise was made to Ukraine and Georgia that they would someday become members. That's in writing, black and white, on the final declaration of the Bucharest summit.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, so in a way, yeah, that will happen the day when it actually no longer becomes necessary. The day when Moscow is actually a friendly and, you know, neighbor, then it becomes safe to let Georgia into NATO.
Yes. Andreas, I know you have some thoughts on this because you've written a bit about this problem.
I had an article with exactly this line at the end where I said that the paradox is that these countries, I mean, I'm here in Ukraine and I see how people look at NATO with how much hope they look at NATO. They think they will adapt the standards of their army to NATO. They will then have a referendum in NATO, and then they will apply for the membership action plan, and then they will apply for membership, and then they will get into NATO. That's what many people think, unfortunately, here in Ukraine. But that is not going to happen. And the paradox is that Ukraine and Georgia as well, they are not only going to become members of NATO when they don't need NATO's protection anymore, in a way, you could argue. So that's the problem. I think the main problem in all of that is Western Europe. I think I would think that there are many people, politicians in Eastern Europe who would understand that Ukraine and Georgia are so important for them, and that they would give them security assurances. I also, obviously, we had already the Bucharest summit. In the US, there are strong voices for that. Canada as well, I would say. But in Western Europe, there are just some countries that will not take in these Ukraine and Georgia. So I've been now writing these articles about this concept of intermarium, of an alliance of a coalition of the willing, of an alliance of countries that have the same problem basically with Russia, and that may be ready to give each other, and mainly to Moldova, Ukraine and Georgia, security assurances, maybe not security guarantees, but security assurances, and that would then assist each other, and maybe that could be even formalized in a formal contract, in a formal agreement. I think that's the best that Georgia and Ukraine can hope for now. I would certainly prefer other options. I would prefer a regime change in Moscow, or a policy change in Moscow. I would prefer the EU giving security assurances to Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia within the association agreements. The association agreements, as I read them, would actually allow for that, because there are chapters on security. I would prefer a NATO plus, maybe NATO giving security assurances that would be below membership but still sufficiently strong. But I don't see this happening, again, because of the West European countries. And I would mostly prefer, of course, NATO membership for Ukraine and Georgia, but this is also not going to happen. And if all of these options are not possible or are not feasible, then I think the only option that remains, apart from doing nothing, basically, is for Ukraine and Georgia to look for local allies, to look for allies in Eastern Europe, in the Black Sea region, to intensify cooperation with, especially with Turkey, Romania, and Poland, and maybe then to start negotiating a treaty that would formalize such security assurances.
Are you talking basically about a collective security agreement between Ukraine, Georgia, and Moldova? Is that what we're talking about, or are there any outsiders?
Well, in a way, that does already exist. That's the GUAM.
Yeah.
So, but that doesn't help at all, because these are weak countries. The main issue here is whether one of the big countries of the Black Sea and East European region would be ready to give security assurances to Georgia, Moldova, and Ukraine, Poland, Romania, and Turkey. That is the main issue. And I would even suspect if one of these countries would decide to do so and to give such security assurances, other countries and also smaller countries may just join in if they see this happening, and maybe that's the way to go. I don't see it now happening, but if the current situation continues for another 2-3 years, I think this discussion will become almost natural. I think all of the actors in the region will start thinking about what to do actually with the situation, and sooner or later, I see something like an intermarium emerging.
Mark, what do you think about that? It's an interesting concept.
It's an interesting concept. My thought is, let's say Poland decides to step in and provide security guarantees for Ukraine. Well, apart from, again, we come back to, I mean, the field day that Russian propagandists would have with that. But when it comes down to it, let's say that's the case, and then Russia launches some new limited but clearly visible offensive in the Donbass. What realistically is Poland going to do? I mean, Poland is not going to declare war on Russia, obviously. Is Poland going to send troops? Maybe they could send in troops to sort of secure Kiev, let's say, but if that's not the Russian objective. I think this is one of the problems that we have with the regime that is actually willing to both lie in its teeth to its own people and to the international community, but also actually is much more willing to use violence and coercion than most. It's actually very hard to constrain within the, you know, without actually sort of moving to really quite serious military means. And so this is what I come back to. I mean, I think Andreas's point about the European Union being the best place to provide some kind of security assurances, I mean, I think that is why the EU, we keep coming back to the EU. You know, if it is to be meaningfully something more than just a common market, the sort of the way the Brits sort of loved it, then actually, you know, it needs to move much more specifically into the area of security, broadly conceptualized, not just military, and that means also being willing to look elsewhere, as it were, stabilizing its neighborhood, rather than just simply sitting behind its borders and saying, you know, we only care what happens on this side of the lines on the map. No one country can actually sort of provide any sort of meaningful security. I mean, even, let's say, Turkey, which, you know, does have an extensive and formidable, if sometimes erratic, military force.
And which just made up with Russia.
Well, yes, but, you know, then give it 6 months and who knows. But the point is, again, you know, would it actually deploy military force to defend another country against Russia? And if so, what would be the implications there? I actually find this quite worrying. Again, and it would also potentially take off the emphasis on sort of broader alliances. So intermarium, I mean, I think it's, you know, obviously it's fine. But in particular, for me, The real advantage of such coalitions is not they're actually providing direct assurances and guarantees. It's actually that they can provide assistance to try and make these countries harder targets. Mm. Harder targets politically, economically, but also militarily. I mean, actually, you know, we're already seeing considerable progress being made, particularly with the Ukrainian military. I mean, Georgia has a limit just because it's just so small. Moldova, because it's small and ludicrously impoverished. Ukraine is a country which actually has the potential to build itself up with military forces that aren't obviously on a par with Russia, but are sufficiently coherent, effective, and properly trained and equipped that they actually can basically mount a kind of a credible resistance.
If you could replicate the military reform that took place in Georgia in Ukraine, then Ukraine would have quite a formidable military given its size. Georgia's military is reformed, but Georgia's small. Ukraine's military is largely unreformed, but Ukraine's big. If you could, if the Ukrainians could learn from what the Georgians did with their military, because they have done quite amazing things with their military, particularly since the war in 2008, this would be something to
see. I mean, I think it would be very, very difficult because there are some. It's the same way as, you know, Georgia could reform its police force in a way that almost no other country could, with some best just mass sackings. And it's very hard to replicate that except on a very local level, as has been done in Ukraine. But actually, in some ways, I think Europe has got some good examples. If you look at many of the post-Soviet states, countries like Poland, I think actually their experiences in modernizing and reforming their militaries. You know, quite large ones that also rely on sort of, you know, larger formations, actually, I think, have a lot of lessons for Ukraine. And again, that is one of the areas in which, you know, Poland, or to a lesser extent, Czech Republic, Romania, Hungary, and so forth, can actually provide assistance to Ukraine, especially if someone else is also willing to provide some money, which actually would be meaningful.
Well, you mentioned the EU, Mark, which gives us the perfect segue to go to what we wanted to talk about in the second half. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the impact last week's bombshell Brexit referendum will have on the NATO alliance. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Kyiv is Andreas Umland of the Institute of Euro-Atlantic Cooperation in Kyiv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Итоги британского референдума по выходу из Евросоюза сегодня активны.
Последствия британского референдума...
Вашингтон заявляет, что особое отношение между США и Великобританией...
Владимир Путин считает, что Brexit связан с нежеланием британцев...
Все это отразится на бюджете...
Next week's NATO summit is taking place in the hypercharged atmosphere following the Brexit referendum. There seems to be two conflicting opinions about how Brexit will impact NATO, with some arguing that the centrifugal forces pulling apart the EU will have a contagion effect and cause splits in NATO as well. Others are arguing the opposite, that the UK will now double down on its commitment to the alliance. Mark, how do you see this here in London? Ground zero.
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, desperate though I am to find even just a small scrap of silver lining in the dark storm cloud that is Brexit, I confess I don't really see the likelihood of a doubling down on the alliance. I think actually there is a greater risk, only a risk, not a certainty, that this will actually have a certain kind of infection to NATO. If I was going to try and find a silver lining, I would instead bring it back to the European Union. I mean, historically, Britain has always been one of the countries which has been least enthusiastic about the idea of a common foreign and security policy within the European Union. So, although on the one hand, Britain actually, you know, did more than just carry its own weight within the EU. I mean, they basically sort of committed they were responsible for about 15% of EU security operations and so forth, and command the anti-piracy operations off Somalia and such like. But nonetheless, with the UK out of the picture, we might actually begin to see some proper momentum towards some kind of European Union. Sort of security dimension. And this is clearly what is in mind with Federica Mogherini's new sort of global strategy, which after all is the first new one the EU has had since 2003, which talks much more about, you know, more defence cooperation. It has much stronger language about Russia, calling it a challenge, which by EU standards is
by Mogherini standards is revolutionary. But go ahead.
Exactly. So you know, we do see actual sort of movement within the EU. So yes, there is going to be this tension. I mean, I think inevitably, even just on a human level, depending on how the divorce talks between the UK and the EU go, that may well splash through into NATO, however much everyone wants to try and avoid that. That's inevitable. But on the other hand, what it could mean is actually that the EU becomes a more effective element of this structure, which actually would be a really great step forward for all the reasons that we were talking about in the first part of this podcast, that it actually allows much greater use of non-kinetic ways of deterring and punishing aggression.
Andreas?
Yes, I would agree with that. I also hope that this crisis will lead to a serious rethinking of the EU. That has been the history of the EU, that usually crises had this sort of dialectical meaning, that there were a problem for a while for the EU, but often the end result of the crisis was then an improvement in integration and further steps towards integration. And I would expect something like that here too. I could also see a certain restructuring of the whole European integration idea along the lines of the ideas of Jacques Delors, a former EU commissioner who had this idea of concentric circles in Europe, where you would have a core that would go ahead with deep integration, in effect forming something like a federation, and then you would have around this core you would have concentric circles to which then also Britain could belong. If it indeed leaves the European Union. So I would agree with Mark that this could actually have a very healthy effect for Europe, although now, of course, most people think of it as a catastrophe. I simply cannot imagine that Britain will sort of leave the European context. It may leave formally the European Union, but and even that I think is under question whether they will eventually do that, because then apparently it would be just England and Wales and maybe Northern Ireland, but probably Scotland not. I mean, it's like it looks already now. So I think the England would be still part of the European context, but the European Union itself would reform itself. Often these sort of shocks are quite useful. The Union, I think, has become overly bureaucratized, dominated by bureaucrats, by diplomats, and it has to become more political again and think of it as a political project. And I think that is now starting. In the end, I think it's going to be beneficial. And I would even be as cynical as saying that the worse the effects of the Brexit are going to be for Britain, the better in a way for the Union, because it would illustrate to the world and to the other member countries, and not only to the member countries of the EU, how important the EU is. And I could imagine then at some point that actually Britain will return if it indeed leaves the European Union. So what this all means for NATO is difficult to say, but what one could probably say that if indeed Britain leaves the EU, it would probably switch to the sort of more Anglo-Saxon context, to consulting with countries like the US, with Canada, with Australia. Maybe, for instance, it would coordinate its sanctions against Russia, not any longer that much with the EU, but rather with Australia, Canada, and the US. So I don't see this as such a catastrophe as others. Although for now it looks indeed as a major blow to European integration.
Well, I want to just play devil's advocate before I go to you, Mark. I'm first of all I agree with you, Andreas. I don't think Brexit's a done deal. I just don't see anybody pulling the Article 50 trigger anytime soon. Nobody seems to have the appetite for it, not even Boris Johnson. That's number one. So I'm not sure this is over. You've raised the Scottish issue. The Scots have pledged to block this. There's questions about the constitutionality of that. But the Scots seem determined to block this. And if they can't block it, of leaving the UK. Maybe it's just naive hope, but I think the UK is going to step back from the brink here. But even if it doesn't, there is no appetite for Britain watering down its role in NATO. I've seen no evidence of that whatsoever. Mark, you're in London, maybe you have, but I've seen no evidence from that. I had no reason to doubt David Cameron's statement to Parliament this week, where that Britain will remain a strong member of NATO. So I'm not so sure this is going to have the knock-on effects. Mark, you wanted to jump in with something else, and feel free to knock me down.
Well, first of all, I should say I love Andreas's notion of the rather kind of Hegelian approach to the European Union, that it is currently facing its antithesis, from which a sort of grand new synthesis will emerge. But when we go back to the UK's role, and yes, it may well be that the Brexit won't happen, and we'll wait and see. If it does, I mean, I think I would question actually whether or not we'll see a great enthusiasm for adopting the rather more stringent sanctions regime of the Americans, because I think there'll be a tendency instead to go back to a much more sort of liberal model. In other words, please, please, desperately, international community, give us your money, which will actually make Britain less, I think, rather than more amenable to that. But yeah, let's go and talk about the impact on NATO. I absolutely agree that there is no question at all of the United Kingdom choosing to dilute its commitment to NATO. That is absolutely not the case. It's more about the practical implications. First of all, Well, if the British economy goes into a period of extended, shallow but nonetheless distinct decline, the question will be actually of spend. Technically, Britain hits the 2% GDP target. There's some question as to how far. That's because certain other expenditures really have been kind of rolled into the defence budget to make it a slightly arithmetic process. But nonetheless, it'll be harder for the UK to maintain that. Secondly, there are actually some outstanding issues. I mean, it might just have been sabre-rattling, but Spain's very much making the case that if Brexit happens, then Gibraltar is up for grabs. So there may well be other internal tensions that inevitably get in the way. More to the point, we've got to realize the extent to which, you know, these are issues not just simply of military capability, but of political unity and will. And I think the reason why Brexit is something that Putin clearly has appreciated and the Russian elite is sort of on the whole celebrating is because of the sense that it actually will distract the West. It creates divisions, it creates more grounds for just internal soul searching and so forth. Anything that helps distract the West, anything that helps create these internal tensions, makes Western structures less formidable in the Russian eyes. And we've got to remember, this is perceptional. So even if in fact NATO is every bit as strong and united as ever, if the Russians believe it is not as strong and united as it was before, then they will act accordingly. So this is my concern. I mean, it may well be that this is just simply the worst case scenario, but I do have my concerns about how Brexit will play out, at least in the immediate term.
Now, Mark, you wrote in a piece for Vox this week that Russia will soon regret its cheering on of Brexit. Would you care to recount your argument?
Well, yeah, I mean, beyond the fact that it may well just not have the kind of distracting impact that Russia assumes, I think there is also this point that the European Union, for the very reasons for which Russians often sort of frankly sneer at it, because it is values-driven, it is bureaucratic, it is frankly quite slow, it's conservative, it's very much looking for kind of building consensus. For all those reasons, it actually acted as a control on more aggressive countries. And here, particularly Poland is the obvious one. And, you know, a country which has strong historical animus towards Russia, has a nationalist government, has clearly an ambition to be considered to be a regional power. And actually, if the European Union begins to actually fragment, which again, I should say I don't expect to happen, but I think it's part of the calculations in Moscow, if it does begin to fragment, then actually these countries might well actually feel freer to operate than before. Second thing is actually the United States. If the United States begins to think that Europe is not such a useful partner, unless it's willing to just simply abandon Europe altogether, which I don't believe it would, instead it will again look for much more targeted bilateral relationships. And these need not just simply be with European countries. Yes, it could be Poland, but it could be Turkey, it could be in Central Asia. So again, I mean, what it might mean is an end to a rather cozy arrangement, which actually Moscow had got quite good at playing, and instead a return to one in which actually there's more individual powers emerging, and the relative limits of Russia's capacity to assert hard and soft power become more and more visible.
This would be ironic, because what Moscow has always seemed to want was to go back to this bilateral way of dealing with people. But again, be careful what you wish for. You may get it, is what you seem to be saying.
Absolutely.
So, Andreas, any last thoughts on this before we wrap it all up?
I've seen Mark's article. I should read it, but maybe he had it in this article. I mean, one of the effects that Russia may not be hoping for of the Brexit is that the U.S. will look for another partner in Europe, and this will then obviously be Germany. And if the Brexit leads to an intensification of bilateral relations between Germany and the U.S., this is maybe not something that that Russia was hoping for. The other comment I wanted to make to on Mark, I think he's very right that the signal that this that the Brexit could send to Moscow is that the West is weak, the West is distracted, the EU is incapable of acting, and that could indeed create a dangerous situation. That's I think why I think that also. Increases the case for the Intermarium or for a security alliance in Eastern Europe, which also would send a signal to Moscow that Moscow would not be dealing with singular weak states like Ukraine, Moldova, or Georgia, but if it chooses to escalate with these countries, it will get immediately into a confrontation with a larger alliance. That's also about signaling. I think that would be also my main argument, this sort of information, not the information war, but what kind of information do you send to the other side? That would be also a major argument then for the Intermarium. And in a way, you could even link the Brexit to an increased need for a signal from Eastern Europe that Eastern Europe is ready to defend itself, and not only the NATO and EU member countries, but also countries like Ukraine, Georgia, and Moldova.
On that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Kyiv has been Andreas Umland of the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation in Kyiv. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening and lively discussion. And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFURL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. You can also follow Pavel on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will not appear next week as I will be on the road attending the NATO summit. But we'll be back on July 15th with a special on-the-road edition from Tartu, Estonia. So until then, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.